Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to start our show today by taking a look at the role culture may play and how our children learn and succeed and how children learn and succeed in other parts of the world. Our guest today, Cornelius Grove, with us by phone. He's a partner of Grovewell LLC, has a doctorate of education taught in both the U.S. and Beijing, and is the author of The Aptitude Myth. And we're going to talk with him about his latest book, which is titled The Drive to Learn. What do you think? Do you think American kids aren't as driven as kids in other countries? What have you done to get your children involved in their education? I hope you'll join the conversation. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. And check out the new Ideas Network Facebook page. It's right on the Larry Mueller Show page. You can like that one. We'd love to have you do that as well. Cornelius Grove, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
It's my delight to be with you. I'm very happy to be interviewed by an NPR station. I'm talking to you folks from Brooklyn, New York.
Wow. Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. I've enjoyed reading your book.
Thank you.
Opened my eyes a little bit to some difference, although I'm a professor here at the UW-Madison as well. So mm-hmm. I've been exposed to some of it, but I'm telling you, things are looked at quite a bit differently in Asian countries when it comes to education, especially at the family level, than here in the U.S.
The differences are not necessarily easy to observe on the surface.
Right.
People do observe things on the surface, and as revealed by very careful anthropological and sociological research, when people just look at the surface, they get things pretty wrong. And so the differences are deep, and they are significant, and they have outcomes for children's education.
You taught at the university in Beijing for some time. Talk about the difference you noticed in your students in China compared to your students here in the States.
Well, let me say first of all that my experience in China was at the graduate level.
Mm-hmm.
My book focuses almost exclusively on very young children, and because I believe that and I think many people would agree that those first years of life at home and very early years in school are the ones that set the tone. I certainly noticed in my teaching something that many others have noticed and commented on, usually reaching the wrong conclusion, and that is that students in East Asia tend to be quiet. They tend not to ask questions. They're very respectful, and so they're very often criticized as being passive and uninterested and just wanting to learn and parrot back what the teacher's telling them, those conclusions could hardly be more wrong. It's true that they are quiet, but they're not quiet because they're uninterested. As a matter of fact, and paradoxically, they're quiet because they're very interested.
Yeah.
They're very interested in what the professor has to say, because the professor and the textbook are sources of knowledge, and knowledge is very important to acquire and to master. And so we don't interrupt the professor by asking questions or offering our own comments. That comes later. There are other times for that, as I think I pointed out in the book. But class is kind of a sacred time, and the professor has prepared a lesson that many researchers have described as a performance, meaning that it's rehearsed, it's well thought out, it gets kids thinking. It may throw some questions out, especially in the younger grades, and have answering and demonstrating proofs and mathematics and so forth and so on. But anyway, this is the most observable difference. I certainly lived it myself.
Yeah, and it's such a difference from, I think, from the United States, as you're right about. I think the difference in how teachers are perceived in the United States versus how they are perceived in some Asian countries is quite a bit different.
It's a very significant difference. In Asia, in East Asia, which is my focus, and by the way, East Asia is China, Japan, and Korea. Mm-hmm. Most of the research has occurred in China, including Taiwan and Japan. Less research is coming out of East Asia. Let me just interrupt myself there to say that the book is based not on my personal research,
right,
but on my relying on a veritable mountain of research that has accumulated since 1970, over 500 published studies, all of them accessible on the web, The research was driven by the fascination, which I think is the same as yours and mine and many other people have said, how come on those international comparative tests, the East Asian students and some other cultures as well, Singapore comes to mind, always do better, much better than the American students. How could this be? How can we explain this? But the gift that all these researchers, and eventually it was an international effort, gave us was that they did not just look at what was going on in schools. They looked at every conceivable factor that might help to explain this, which means that they looked a great deal in homes. And the difference, I believe, their research adds up to say that yes, there are different things going on in schools, no doubt about it, and we should be noticing that. And by the way, that's probably my next book. Mm-hmm. I thought it would be part of this book, but I gradually came to see that the real story here, the main part of the story, is what's happening at homes and as driven by the culture of East Asia.
Yeah, and the culture, and we've got Greg in Milwaukee has some comments for us, but hold on there for a minute, Greg. We'll get to you here. The culture within the family is really what is the big difference that may drive East Asian students.
Yes, that's right. Because for historical reasons, which I explain not at great length. No. My book is actually quite short. You may have noticed. For historical reasons, it came to be believed first in China, and then more broadly in East Asia, that academic learning, mastery of written knowledge, is extremely important, extremely valuable, and extremely desirable. And this became gradually a way in which East Asian families, which are much more united and single-minded as a group than American families here in our individualistic culture, it's a way for them to receive honor and what the Asians call face in among their peers, among their community. The children's learning is a way for families to gain deep respect among other members of the community, and not only the children doing very well in school, but in addition, the children being seen to study long and hard in order to do well in school. And so the entire family is united on the value and the importance of academic learning. And this is very, very different from the culture of the United States.
Talk about that difference a little.
Well, I think to understand what's going on in the United States, it would anybody who's really interested in how we came to be as we are here would do very well to read a well-respected historical study entitled Anti-Intellectualism in American Life by Richard Hofstadter. I believe it was published in 1970. It's a very insightful book, and I did rely on it for the latter chapters in my book, The Aptitude Myth. I think my book, The Aptitude Myth, also contributes to understanding because I tried in The Aptitude Myth to trace historically where the American belief comes that the main thing that explains whether kids do well or not so well in school is their inborn aptitude. That has a long history, which I traced in that book. You know, in East Asia, they know about aptitude. They know about IQ tests, but they don't pay very much attention to it because they say that, you know what, it's about effort. It's about working hard, drilling, practicing, the same kind of spirit that we bring to high school athletics in this culture. Is that spirit of work hard, work long, be persistent, never give up, improve, learn from your mistakes. That is the spirit that drives East Asian families and their children. And that is the drive to learn. That's why my book has that title.
Yeah. My eyebrow went up and shot up a little bit in a little knowing smile when I read that example in your book about how we look at perhaps athletics.
Yeah.
More like the East Asians may look at book learning.
That's right. That's right. And one of the, and you'll also recall that one of the very good comparisons that has been drawn is the idea that many families here in the United States, and by the way, we're dealing in generalities here. Of course, we're not talking about every single family. But in general, it's true that in the United States, and this is not just an anecdotal observation, but also has been revealed by research, that parents generally relate to their children's school experience as a cheerleader or as an encourager. They want the child to succeed, no doubt about that. It's not that they don't care, but the child being an individual, developing his or her individual habits and skills and ways of life and talents is encouraged to do just as well as they possibly can as far as their aptitude takes them. And the parents are much more like a cheerleader and an encourager to enable them to do that. But in East Asia, where it's not about aptitude but rather about effort, the parents there are much more in the realm of a coach or a trainer. And you think about the difference between cheerleaders at high school football games and coaches at high school football games or any football game. The coach is so much more involved and involved not only at the game but in between the games. The coach has set standards. It calls for repeated practice and drilling and trying again and running those plays, practice, and even disciplining players if they don't measure up, if they break rules about curfews or whatever it might be, and only putting out the best players. This is much more like the way that East Asian parents relate to their children.
Well, let's turn to Greg in Milwaukee, who has some things to share with us. Greg, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I was a single father. My wife took off when my daughter was 4 months old. She got postpartum depression, and I had to drop out of college. And I didn't know how to sing baby songs or anything like that, so I would hold my daughter, and I would sing like hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, fluorine, neon, sodium, helium. And I'd sing like 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, 21, 24, 27, 30, all the multiplication tables, all the common squares. I squared is negative 1, negative 1 squared is 1. And things like 4/3, pi r cubed is the volume of a sphere, and anything I could think of, quadratic equation, all sorts of stuff, when she was just an infant. And I did it every time I changed her diaper. And it took a long time before she asked me, what does that mean, hydrogen, helium, and that? And I told her that's what everything's made out of. It's stuck together certain ways, and they always stick together the same ways. And that's what makes matter. And then whenever I trapped animals, fur bearers, and whenever I'd turn over a piece of bark in the woods and find a salamander during winter or fall, I would take that thing home and stick it in a terrarium. I mean, I had leopard frogs that were too big to ever breed in the wild because they just were too big. They don't hibernate. But she saw all this stuff. I even picked up Polyphemus and Cecropia cocoons and hatched them in cages for her. And when she was like 4 and a half years old, she ran up to the table by my cousin Susie's house and she said, "Cousin Susie, you have a Polyphemus moth."
Well, how did she turn out?
She got a master's in executive management, human resources, and I was always training her to get her to go towards the sciences, but she was a princess of her prom, and she was a real people person. I don't know why.
Cornelius Grove, how does Greg's experience fit in?
Well, that's a very unusual, indeed a unique way, I think, of bringing a child's attention to a wide range of academic matters. I can't say that I've heard of anything of that sort in all my reading about East Asia and my experience there or here.
Isn't he sort of acting as a coach in a way?
Well, I think that it's not quite in the same way that an East Asian parent would do it, but I absolutely would not criticize what he did. It's actually quite interesting, and I would imagine it had a beneficial impact, and especially when she started asking questions.
Sure.
But it is unusual, let's face it, and I think it's very interesting. I will remember that.
Greg, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. You can join in as well. How do your kids learn, or how do you help your children learn? I hope you'll join in. Cornelius Grove, our guest today, he's the author of a really interesting book. It's called The Drive to Learn. Subtitle is What the East Asian Experience Tells Us About Raising Students Who Excel. Join in the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer on the Ideas Network. Right now, visiting with our guest, author Cornelius Grove, who has written The Drive to Learn, What the East Asian Experience Tells Us About Raising Students Who Excel. Again, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Cornelius, I have a student sitting in with me today in the show, and just during this little break that we had, she wondered, asked to me, how is it that East Asian parents can get their kids to do math when they don't like it?
I think that when education is the most important thing, when academic learning is the number one top goal of a family, of a family that considers itself a unit, not a collection of individuals, which is much more common in the United States, but a single unit, that what the child likes doesn't really enter into it. And that's a terrible thing to say to a young individualist here in the United States, I realize. But we're talking about now a culture, another culture on the other, literally on the other side of the world, that in many, many deep ways is very, very fundamentally different from American culture. And it's true that I'm not arguing that I'm not trying to hold forth that every East Asian child loves math. I'm saying that whether or not they love math is not something that really comes up. It is important to the family and to their future and to their respect as a student who gains a great deal of admiration for studying long and hard. It's important that they learn math, and it may be harder for them than for others. You know, in our culture where we put so much emphasis on aptitude, we say, well, students do well in school or not well in school mainly because of the gifts that they were given when they were born, their potential. Some students have more potential for learning math than others. In East Asia, they know, maybe I said this before, I had another interview today, so I'm getting confused, but in East Asia, they know about aptitude, but they put their, they say, well, that's okay. If you have less aptitude in math, then you'll just study math harder in order to even the playing field. And it's really not about what you like. It's not about anything like learning styles. None of that is discussed in Asia.
I was just, as you were talking, I was just thinking about a colleague who was talking with me about one of his graduates, East Asian graduate students, who is in a communications, it's a PhD in communications program, but kept taking more and more mathematics and statistics classes and way beyond what he needed. And he asked the student, why are you doing this? And the student said, well, I needed a little break from the harder material. So,
you mean the communication material?
Yeah. So the math was, something that he knew inside and out. Aaron and Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is for Cornelius, and I was wondering in all the studies and book writing, if you came across differences in mental health in youth between U.S. and East Asia, and how that impacts learning and academic drive. You know, you were talking about the high level of drive from the family side, and I'm wondering if that plays into stress and mental health during or later on in life.
Good question.
That's a great question because it is in our individualistic culture, this seems as though, when just looked at from the outside, it seems as though East Asian kids have all these demands expected of them. They're supposed to be studying into the night and on and on and this must affect them. They must hate it. They must rail against it. And perhaps there's a few that do. Again, we're dealing in broad generalizations here, but the research on this is absolutely clear. The nature of East Asian parenting is really a very close association, a partnership also almost between the parents and the children. The parents give the children a great deal of guidance. They not only encourage them, they don't worry about their self-esteem. Self-esteem is something you get from doing really, really well, and that's the only way that you get it, that means anything. They are very strong in guidance. They, as some of the literature actually speaks of the parents almost managing their child, managing with love, managing with deep concern, managing with a focus on the future, managing for the honor and the face of the family being highly important, but nevertheless managing their child. Larry, you'll remember that in the book I come up with the word Chinese word guan.
Yeah.
And I don't want to get into guan today, but this is what we're talking about here, and there are comparable terms in Japanese as well. And Western researchers, American researchers, saying, God, the kids must be really suffering under this regime. That so much they're told what to do and this and that. Unfortunately, the research has shown pretty much the opposite. If the parents don't do this in East Asia, that's when the kids get upset. They really appreciate this. They want this kind of guidance. One of the things that is, I'm actually writing an op-ed piece right now about this. One of the things that brought a great deal of comment and criticism in the United States about 6 years ago was Amy Chua's book about the tiger mother. And some people got very upset with this. And there were some commentators that said, oh my God, those poor girls. There was one commentator that said, those girls are going to end up with mental illness and stress. They'll just be washouts as adults. They must hate this. The stress is just too much for them. Well, I invite anybody. The two daughters of Amy Chua are easy to find on the web. You should look into their careers now. They're doing wonderfully well. When they're frequently asked if they would raise their own children the same way, and they say, yeah, we sure would. So Yeah, it just hasn't worked out this way at all. Again, we're dealing in generalizations. I'm sure there's exceptions. I'm not saying everybody is alike, but in general, the news is very good about how East Asian children bear up under this.
Mm. Thanks again, Aaron. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Orville in Madison next. Orville, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for taking my call, and thanks to your guests for this program. I want to ask him a couple questions. I want to make a recommendation. First is, what has been the effect of the Chinese Imperial Civil Service exams on the attitude of the East Asians to education? And secondly, what are the inimical effects of this kind of pressure on the children to learn? And I want to make a recommendation. I'm a poor person. I'm not a particularly gifted person, but I've earned 5 science degrees and 1 liberal arts degree. And I think it's due largely to the fact that my mother taught me to read before I went to school. My mother has been dead 50 years, but every degree that I earn it to please my mother.
Yeah.
Well, let me say, first of all, that the way that you think about this and the way your mother think about this does actually remind me of East Asian thinking and East Asian values to some extent. You asked a question about, I believe your second question was something about the pressure on this, and I think I had just answered that question, that mm-hmm. research has been unable to come up with dire instances of mental illness among East Asian children. But I'm glad you asked the question about the imperial exams in China. They ran for 1,300 years. They were ended in the early 1900s, exactly 1,300 years after they began. And this was the way in which poor farm boys, poor peasant boys, and for a long time it was only boys, could vault themselves to status and prestige and power. These were absolutely equal opportunity exams. Anybody could take them. The problem wasn't that there were things that kept there weren't rules that kept people out, but young men studied for years with tutors. They had to devote pretty much really very close to all of their time. They could not just do it as homework after a day of farming. This was a full-time job studying for these exams, and then whoever did well on them, and we're talking only about the top 1%. The full pass rate was tiny. They went into positions of power, but that was one of the legacies of the growth in China, which had started centuries before, in respecting academic learning, and this was sort of the pinnacle of respect for academic learning. And I think your question is good because we still see how students approach tests in East Asia, the legacy of those imperial examinations.
Yeah, interesting. Thank you, Orville. Francisco in Sister Bay, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, I'm very gratified by the observations of the writer as to the Eastern people, Chinese and Japanese work. I am a migrant worker. I pick potatoes, picked cotton, and did everything in the fields between Texas and here. I went to grade school 3 months out of the year. I was 18 when I graduated from the 8th grade. I was 12 when I was in the 3rd grade, and I decided to go to college, and they let me in, and I got my associate degree, then I went to Creighton, got my BA, and then I went to Drake, and I went and got my master's. I went to Hastings College of the Law, I got my law degree, I came back, went to UWM, and got my PhD on a fellowship, I'm a PhD fellow. And I just want to tell you that because I have observed that education is manipulated by the upper classes to keep the poor classes down. And I don't know how you can explain my achievements. I cannot. I don't know how I did it, but I did not know any English when I went to school, when I was at Creighton. I never had a high school diploma. They made up a high school diploma to give it to me so I could graduate from Creighton. And I just want
to... Yeah, a comment on that. Well, thank you, Francisco, for calling. Thoughts from you, Cornelius Grove?
Well, hats off to this gentleman. I deeply admire what he did, and I think we can say, in addition to anything else, that he brought a drive to learn to what he was doing. He brought persistence. He brought determination. He did not let setbacks get him down. He found a way to persist. And this kind of behavior over many years is just incredibly admirable. We in the United States, we generally have a great deal of respect, as I am feeling now, for what he accomplished. I know that there are critiques of American culture which point to ways in which the upper classes keep the lower classes down. I think some of those have merit. I have heard it said, yes, in terms of education sometimes as well. And I think that is reprehensible and unfortunate, but some people manage to crash through it. And I think what we have here is a gentleman which has my great admiration for crashing through it and making it happen in spite of all the many barriers that he had to face.
Yeah. Thank you so much for calling again, Francisco. Nancy in Grafton, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Nancy.
Well, good morning.
Morning.
You know, not all people need to go to college. I think there is nothing wrong with learning how to work with your hands. We have the largest family in town here, and we have masons, we have cement finishers, we have people who can cut trees, but we have teachers, and we have people working in administration and so many different fields. My opinion is do what makes you feel fulfilled. Don't do something because somebody says, oh, you should be this, you should be that. Do what makes you feel good. At the end of the day, when you're finished working, that you said, gee, I did a darn good job today. And people say, boy, you really did good work. Do that. Make you feel good about it. And it should not all have to be about degrees and all that stuff. Maybe it is. Maybe that makes you feel good. But if you feel good at the end of the day because of what you did, what you accomplished, and how people think about you, that's what counts.
Oh, thank you very much for calling, Nancy. Cornelius, comment?
I would not disagree with any of that at all. And I would just say that the underlying opinion that she expressed is one that would be more commonly found in the United States, which is a highly individualistic culture and very much values people following their interests and their you know, the priorities that they develop as they grow up and their potential. And this leads people in different avenues and so forth and so on. And some of those people are more intellectually inclined and so forth and so on. This is a typical American opinion, and I'm an American, and I like that opinion. But it's different from what many East Asians would have to say. That's all I have to say.
Let's go to Dennis in Elmwood next. Dennis, hi.
Hi. Say, I got to agree with the last two callers, and I have to say that... that some of that is generational. My dad and my mom used to argue who was poorer, and my mom says everybody was poor. He says some are poorer than others because he had large sandwiches he took to school. They didn't have shoes, they didn't have this and that, and they walked to school. Okay, so I mean, that's from 1914, and how he's 13, he quit school. And he made a heck of a nice life for himself. Okay, so I'm just saying that when you keep on going through, that I ended up farming, too, by default, I guess. And math. I was going to say math and music and physics. It is the base. It's the everything. But the kids would come in here, and I had my own three, and I had three nephews, and I had three or four others that would all just show up, you know what I mean, from doing hay and doing all this stuff. And we'd just sit around. And right now, they're not all mathematicians. Some are fixing roads. Some are doing fixing engines. But when I see them, they say, it's all physics, isn't it, Dennis?
So you're sort of echoing, Dennis, what kind of others were saying then.
Yes. Listen, I spent part of my youth growing up on a farm. I have enormous respect for farmers. I show up every weekend in all the farmers markets around here in Brooklyn. There are three of them, and I usually go to each one of them. I even wear a farmer's hat when I go around on the weekend. I wear a John Deere hat to show my solidarity with farmers. No problem with farmers. Listen, my book, my studies because I am an educator. I do have a doctorate in education, and I've become interested in cultural differences in education. And I, like many others, have been animated by the fact that American students for decades, multiple decades, have on every possible comparison come out behind and below East Asian students on academic measures. That interests me, and so that's what I'm looking at. And I really hope not to be understood in any way as looking down on farmers or other people who work with their hands. I enjoy working with my hands, and I understand what the previous caller was saying is how satisfying it is to do something that's really serviceable and beautiful and useful with your hands. So that just wasn't the focus of my research and the research that I relied on for this particular topic that I have become interested in.
Yeah. And Diane Ravitch, you quote Diane Ravitch in your book. She's an educational historian.
Yes, she is, a very well-respected.
And she says, let the other nations have the higher scores. I prefer to bet on the creative can-do spirit of the American people. I don't remember what else it was, but
yeah. Well, hats off to the creative spirit of the American people. I don't wish to denigrate that in any way. What to say about this? I think at the end of the day, some people have got to have a really solid education, just to sort of push that aside and say it doesn't really matter all that much is I don't think it's helpful. I think that we can have a creative spirit and innovation, and we can also have a terrific education. I admire Diane Ravitch, but I've always not very much admired that expression.
But you used it in your book, Ed.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
And you do come up with, here we are running out of time, I wanted to mention that you do come up with, in one of your chapters, Parenting with Gwan, Seven Commitments to Your Child.
Yep.
Here, I just find it now. And you have, you lay out what East Asian students' parents do and families do, and how we might use some or all of it in our own help with the children that we have.
Yes. And there are seven, and obviously we can't discuss them all. But one I always like to point to, and that is how do parents react to a child's academic failure, not necessarily an F, but doing poorly on a test, less well than hoped and expected. The reaction in the research reveals that the reaction in the U.S. usually is that the parent is most concerned about preserving the child's self-esteem. you know, okay, you didn't do well in the test, and that's unfortunate, but don't let it get you down. You're a person of great worth, and you're going to come through fine, and so forth. In Asia, there's quite a different way of reacting to failure. First of all, there's no concern about self-esteem. If you do well in the test, then you get a boost in self-esteem, and there's no other way to come by it. But East Asian parents look at this as they're become a diagnostician. Now, why didn't you understand this? Let's figure out what, you know, let's go back and see what you had been learning before, and maybe their connections hadn't been made, or maybe you just need to drill and practice more in order to really get some of these basic principles down so you can move ahead on the more difficult questions more rapidly. And parents and children are much more partners in the children's learning. Larry, I hope you noticed that the cover of my book shows a mother and a daughter in a kitchen working on some academic materials. The girl, I think, is in second grade. They have a workbook in front of them. That workbook was not brought from school, but was bought by the mother so that the child could get ahead. They are discussing what is there. They both have pencils in their hand. And this is emblematic of the spirit that East Asian parents bring to their children's schooling. We are in this together. You are going to do very, very well because we are going to do very, very well. The problem is, of course, it takes a lot of parental time. And this is one of the big drawbacks for Americans. We're an individualistic culture, and we're doing our own thing.
Well, I tell you what, you've written a provocative book, and I've really enjoyed reading through it, and frankly, also enjoyed visiting with you today, Cornelius. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Cornelius Grove, with a doctorate in education, he's taught in the U.S. and Beijing, and his book is called The Drive to Learn, What the East Asian Experience Tells Us About Raising Students Who Excel. And we have some more information on our Facebook page about where to get the books and also about his particular site as well. Great to be able to talk with him today. Looking forward also to talking with our next guest. You may have heard of farm-to-school programs, but have you heard of garden-to-school programs? We'll talk about that next with Chef Josh Perkins on the Ideas Network.